Dana, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's an honor to have you today. I followed you for a while now. I forget when I first started following you, but I feel like I followed you for the last like 5 years for some reason. And just recently when I was like reaching out to guests, and I was just like, how I kind of arrive at bringing guests on the show is I think about topics that I want to talk about, and then I think about people who I follow or people who I know that I think could be really good at talking about those things and could just shed a lot of information and their area of expertise on that subject, and we can kind of have a good conversation around it. But when I was coming up with my kind of podcast outline for you and thinking about things I wanted to chat, I felt like everything was so fitting because you do such a good job communicating nutrition and training and all things around endurance stuff, but just general health and wellness as well on your page. And you being a high level athlete also just it just adds to the benefits of all the stuff that we get to talk about today. So I'm really appreciative of you being here, and I've been a fan of yours for a while. So I feel like it's going to be a fun convo, but feel free, do your little podcast intro. Tell us about how you became a dietitian and got into running or, being a triathlete, all that good stuff. And we'll kind of go from there.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much for the compliment. And again, super excited to be here. But gosh, honestly, becoming like a sports dietitian actually stemmed from younger childhood and being involved in sport, which, I'm probably not speaking a new story here. This is typically how this happens. But I was a runner, I was a soccer player, and that's really kind of where I started as an athlete, I guess you could say. From that point, I had a lot of just misguidance from some coaches and trainers and things like that, that unfortunately led to an eating disorder and over a decade of disordered eating habits. And really, when I worked with a dietitian during this time, that I was, gosh, I think I was 13 or 14. I remember telling my mom specifically, I was like, "Mom, I want to be a dietitian. Like, this is what I want to do." And I made it happen. I didn't know quite exactly how to work with athletes. I knew I always wanted to be to do that, and so kind of figured it out along the way. And my goal as a sports dietitian is just to close the gap in education provided to specifically endurance athletes and female athletes at that. I see still pr a pretty big gap there in a lot of sport. So, yeah.
Do you mind if I poke around kind of the early part of your career, your life with eating disorder stuff, and just like what age, what or that was? And you mentioned that the start of that could have been influenced by a potential coach or other people, or was that something that was brought on by yourself, if you can remember? Just tell me about how that came to surface, because I've had people on here. We've talked about eating disorders before, but eating disorders are so. Man, they are so common these days, and they're something that I don't want it to be like this taboo subject of like we should never talk about it because everyone experiences different. It's like I think that's the point to talk about is like how these things can emerge and what are things that maybe us as parents or future parents or whatever we can look out for, and also just our own lived experiences as well to know that other people go through those things too. But tell me about that if you don't mind, and just kind of when that started to happen, how it started to happen, how that kind of unfolded, and just kind of the early phases of the development of that.
Yeah, so I don't think this was, in any bad nature of any of my coaches, but a lot of the talk around nutrition, how to support your body as an athlete, there was a lot of talk around what not to do as well. And I am very much a type A athlete. Hey, endurance athletes out there. And so I took this on myself. I started doing my own research and took it to obviously an extreme. I basically got rid of a lot of foods, and my mom definitely noticed, like, getting my one, I lost a lot of weight, but also being very picky about anything that I ate, not touching any of, like, the fun foods, as I like to call them, out there. And just really changing nutrition habits. And this was, I was just hitting puberty, so my body also was changing as a female. I was 12 at the time, maybe even 11. So really young. I mean, so I, you know, unfortunately in that time, like that was kind of the most intense phase of it, and went through some counseling and treatment and all of that, but the disordered eating habits persisted for sure. And I think this is really common to see, unfortunately. And a lot of that was just me coming to a space of he really truly healing. And I, again, like this certainly can look different for everybody else, for everybody, but I think it's really important to highlight that an eating disorder is a mental health disorder. It's not just as simple as saying eat more, which unfortunately that's what I was told a lot, is just eat more. Just you need to eat this, or like I was on Ensure 6 times a day, and it was like one horrible. The things are disgusting, but it was, you know, the unfortunate reality of like just that time. You know, that was, gosh, 20-ish years ago now. So yeah, that's kind of the bulk of it.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I know it can be sometimes difficult talking about it and reliving it, but it was really
Yeah.
well said. And I wrote something down as you were talking. But it was just how these things can unintentionally start, or how people can unintentionally influence the development or the mindset or just people's psychology around food and exercise and their body. And I think that's the thing that's very complicated about a lot of this. I think that's the thing that is kind of hard for people to conceptualize, or hard to appreciate the fact that that could happen to their kid or could happen to themselves. And you have coaches, people who are quote unquote in your corner and looking out for your best interests and trying to optimize your performance. And some of these things can be a direct result of that, unfortunately. And that's the thing that I find very interesting about eating disorders, especially in like the performance space. I mean, there's obviously a lot of stuff just being alive today with social media, and you know, girls at the age that they have social media now, I imagine is even more difficult with a lot of certain things. But even back then, you know, it's just there's a lot of inputs that can go into the, you know, influence on whether or not, you know, you have good relationship with food, or how you talk to yourself, or what kind of support system you have, and you know, what the messaging is. And I just find that it's very fascinating, because a lot of these things have the ability to start because of things that were said, or habits, or things that were mentioned that, again, the person didn't mean for that to transpire that way, but it could be the impetus for a lot of these things to kind of domino and get to a spot where you're, you know, heading into puberty and you're dealing with an eating disorder and you have a lot of these developmental delays and all these things that were a negative consequence because of it. So I just find that fascinating. It's really hard to appreciate that, because it can happen at such a young age, but I feel like that's more common than people think.
Yeah. And I think, like, overarching, it's just being very cognizant about how we talk about food, and also, like, as a parent, as a coach, you know, as an aunt, whatever the case may be, whoever you have interaction with to kids of a younger age, be aware of how you are with food and your relationship with food, because kids are sponges and they will see it. They notice things, and it's super important. So
For sure. I kind of unrelated, but also related. But I think there's kind of this perception about dietitians, like on social media recently, about how we're just encompassing a lot of us, because I feel like a lot of us think similarly, because we're kind of trained and kind of conditioned to think these ways, and we have experiences that have shaped our perception of the reality that we live in, and how we communicate, and how we educate people, and how we speak to people publicly. But dietitians are just like on edge and a little bitchy and kind of pissed off all the time. We have a stick up our ass, but it's like, it's for these fucking reasons. It's because we have these lived experiences, or we've worked with people through these lived experiences, and we see people in the grocery store, or, you know, track coaches, or people who might have quote unquote good intentions, but the information that they're giving can be extremely harmful. lack context, don't have any nuance, aren't individualized to people at all. And people take that information. And those are things that, again, can kind of grow this seed of insecurity and body dysmorphia and bad relationship with food. And like you said earlier, of like quote unquote bad foods or good foods, like this good or bad food dichotomy. It's like you just see how this nutrition landscape can influence people's mindset these days. And it's no shit that eating disorders, disordered eating patterns are probably the highest they've ever been. And I think that's why people like you and me and other people, we have stick ups our ass because we think before we speak and we think about how the information we talk about can be, interpreted by other people and what they might go and take and use that information for, where other people are, again, unintentionally, moral of the story here, doing harm. But that's where we, I think, have a hard time seeing people, with big accounts spewing misinformation and just like the ricochet effect that it can have on people.
And as dietitians, like we usually are the ones having to undo a lot of that damage. And that's like, I know I'm speaking from personal, is like that's where it gets really hard. Like I see this every single day, like these disordered patterns that have developed because a coach or what have you has told this person they can't eat whatever that is. Like, and I'm like, man, we've got like, we need to stop. So,
Totally. Now it's kind of cool. And I love your story. And, I think your story is similar to a lot of people, myself included, where it's like we have this experience that we had as kids and we find a profession that could potentially help people prevent getting to the place that we were in or help people get out of the place that we've also potentially been in, or at least can empathize with people and have the tools and the ability to get people to a better place than, where they are when we meet them, for example. And I feel like you becoming a dietitian is a great example of that, where you've had this lived experience and then you get to this spot where you're an awesome athlete and you have survived an eating disorder and you have your own experience with that. And now you have the knowledge and the nutrition and the science and everything to back it up and you have the credentials. Like, how did your experience shape your practice or shape the way you think? And how do you think that's changed your approach, I guess? With the athletes, with the clients, with the people that you serve, how you communicate, nutrition information online. Like, is there one or two things that you can think about that, you do differently because you have that experience?
Yeah, I think
You on the spot.
honestly, I think
Yeah, I was
yeah,
excited.
no, I love it. I feel like it, one, it makes me very aware about how I do talk about fueling. And I also think it's because it's why I'm so passionate about like my kind of motto in my practice is fuel fiercely, and that developed from a place of fiercely supporting your body in sport and life and making sure that both coincide, because you cannot hit your peak performance potential if you're not healthy first. And health comes from supporting your body, right? We can't be healthy without the nutrition and kind of that foundation, right? And that truly has shaped my practice in a whole.
I love that. Fuel fiercely. I'm going to write that down. I'll include that in the show notes. But I think that's a really good just descriptor of like how we're treating our body. And again, like how where we want to be likely comes from intentionally fueling instead of trying to diet all the time. And I know my audience, I'm more of a body recomposition and weight loss is a big thing that a lot of people and clients that I serve need or want. And I know the performance side of things is different, but there's a lot of overlap. And if we look at the Venn diagram of like performance nutrition versus weight loss or body recomposition, like that area in the middle, there's a ton of overlap. And I would say fueling is part of that process because even people who might want to lose weight, like there's an element of fueling that is required for them to build strength and to be proud of the way they look and for them to feel good. Instead of just always being in this kind of restrictive mindset that we can kind of see people fall into from a diet culture standpoint, but athletes are not, immune to that type of information or experience either. Like again, there's a lot of overlap between the two populations for sure.
Yeah, 100%.
I'm looking at my list here, and the first thing I want to talk about is resistance training, kind of speaking a little beyond the fueling aspect. I looked back at some of the shows I've had. I've had a handful of other endurance dietitians or athletes on the show, and we've covered a lot of things. We've talked about Red S and disordered eating and eating disorders, and talked about like hormonal health. We've talked about blood work. We've talked about, carbs. We've talked about fat adapting. We've talked about like, different types of periodization around nutrition. We talked about intra-workout nutrition. We've talked about a lot of things from an endurance standpoint, but I realize that we haven't talked a lot about resistance training. And this is something that obviously I'm very passionate about, something that's kind of my shtick and something that I do a lot with my clients as well. But it's incredible for me to see how important resistance training is, especially in endurance athletes and people whose primary form or who preferred form of activity or exercise or sport is on the endurance side of things. And I find that I don't see people talking about that as much as you. I don't see people talking about it at all, quite frankly, sometimes. And I think that it's a missed opportunity and something that I think a lot of people need to hear if you are somebody who is immersed in the endurance world, or if you're somebody who is trying to squeeze out every, percentage of progress. Like, talking about resistance training, incorporating that and reinforcing why that's important, I think is a really good starting point for us today. And again, I bring that up to you because you talk about it a ton, and that's why I appreciate you and your content. But has it always been that way? I just want to ask you a personal question of like, have you always resistance trained? Has it always been part of your training program? Or is it something that you've incorporated more, or worked with coaches, or have realized the importance kind of later on? Like, how was that introduced to you and your kind of like performance endurance pursuits throughout your career?
Yeah, so I was very fortunate and I was actually introduced to strength training pretty early, like in high school, which was awesome. And actually, interestingly, I played soccer, I ran track, I ran cross country, but my cross country coach was the one that really encouraged it. And so that's when I got started. And I would say it certainly has developed over the years quite a bit in realms of the lifts that I do and what that looks like in realms of now moving from just running to triathlon and having more of what I call like functional movements that truly work like the whole body through the core really, which has been huge. And I definitely have to credit my coach for that, for helping me step back, 'cause I came from a place of like pre-triathlon. In between running and triathlon, I did a lot of like powerlifting. So not much running at that point. And that was the strength that I had, which truly was great. I had a lot of muscle to put power, into the pedals, into my swim, all the things. But I thought that just doing kind of all the big heavy lifts was what I needed, and I needed a lot more than that, functionally, to be able to stabilize through my specifically my pelvic floor. And we think about running, we think about biking, like that's really important, for that economy. So
Totally. Yeah. I like that you kind of specified, because I don't want people to sit here and think like, oh, we got to do three sets of bicep curls every day, and that's what's going to, like, we're probably going to be doing some lunging patterns or training our legs, or like you said, doing maybe some core movements or maybe some combo movements. Like, this is where, in the hypertrophy space and like the bodybuilding world, or people just getting into the gym or resistance training, like, your style of lifting might look different than Dana and her clients, or the women's track team, what they might be doing for their training and their resistance training program. And I just want people to appreciate that there's differences in training styles, but the principles are the same, right? It's like, are we lifting? Are we challenging our muscles? Are we trying to get stronger? Are we doing things that are going to give us an advantage in our sport? And again, there's a lot of overlap, but I don't want people to think that if I train like a bodybuilder and I just run a little bit, then I'm going to be this all-star triathlete. It's like, no, like, we kind of have to tailor things a little bit more to your sport and what your kind of individual goals are. But I don't know about you, but like, I know people lift and resistance train as endurance athletes, but, and correct me if I'm wrong, but something that I've seen, but it's almost like they don't take that as serious as their other sport. Rightfully so. We only have a finite amount of things that we could really give a fuck about all the time. But I find that the people who really take the lifting side of things excel and really perform a lot better and have this come a little bit more effortlessly than the people who are just trying to force the sport, try to run or try to accumulate as many miles as possible. It's almost like the yin and yang. It's like they complement one another. Have you seen that in your practice where you have somebody who maybe hasn't been lifting or who does lift, but you actually get them on a actual kind of program or increase the volume and do things that are complementary to their sport that they actually see some meaningful improvements just from changing that kind of independent variable alone?
Yeah, 100%. All the time. I would say I saw that with myself early on, and I've seen it with several athletes where we have shifted from them doing kind of independently their own lifting, which was a lot of power kind of movements, which there's a time and a place, and we can periodize really heavy lifts, especially in the off season when we want to put on a little bit more muscle. We're trying to build that the strength and the power output and all of that. And then as we kind of increase vo training volume, we're moving towards peak season, we then start to shift what those lifts look like. Maybe we're doing more plyometrics and resistance bands and still certainly some heavy lifts in there, especially for my female athletes, but that shift into truly tailored strength is so powerful. The movements that you do are going to be much different, and that's specifically why.
For sure.
So.
Sure. Let's assume, maybe there's someone listening here and they're really into their, runs or they're a triathlete or, they're really into biking or whatever, and they know that lifting is important. Is the benefits that come from lifting, is it strictly just a power output standpoint, or are there other unique benefits that like lifting or having more muscle mass or just being a little bit stronger can benefit people from an endurance performance kind of standpoint? Are there other benefits that you would point out, or is it just like ability to like finish a race? Is that the biggest benefit that people might get from that?
Absolutely not. So many benefits. I think number one is injury prevention. And, we think about swim, bike, run. We are moving in a forward plane of motion all the time. We're not working laterally. So we see a lot of overuse injuries. And so we really need to work different planes of motion. When we are preventing injury, that means you're able to be consistent in your sport, which one is like you're not going to be sidelined, which yay, but also two is you are going to then get stronger because you're able to do it more. You're improving like running, cycling, swim economy and that muscular efficiency by optimizing different movement patterns, delaying time to for to gosh delay time to fatigue. So that improved muscular endurance, better recovery, which I think is huge, and people don't recognize the importance of this, and bone health. I mean, if we are running, can help with bone health too, because we have the force of pounding on the pavement, multi-directional force on the skeletal muscle specifically. But if we are just cycling or just swimming, we don't have that same resistance being applied, and so it's really important, certainly, to add in strength training. And you briefly touched on this, but body composition, right? And this is talked a lot about in cycling. I work with a cycling team, and we talk about this a lot, is like that power to weight ratio. If we can, even if you stay the same weight, but we shift that weight to muscle, think of how much more power you're able to put in those pedals and how much faster you can go, and all the things you're looking to do. So those are like the big ones.
Yeah.
So lots.
Yeah. And that was a leading question. I knew there was a
Yeah.
lot of benefit, but I asked that from a standpoint of maybe a client or somebody who thinks that, yeah, maybe the only benefit of that is maybe just some power output, but I can make up for that by just training harder or increasing my volume or doing other things like that. But I think at the end of the day, what I want people to appreciate is that there is no substitute for resistance training in any shape or form, whether you're a general public kind of client and you're looking to change the way you look, but wanting to improve your metabolic health, to an elite, athlete, endurance athlete, Olympic level athlete, there's nothing that can replace resistance training. And that's why I wanted to have you on the podcast, is for specifying all these other inputs that could benefit your performance that resistance training can actually have meaningful, impacts on. But it's something that once you start doing, and I know you can probably resonate with this, you realize how much better you feel. You realize how much more confident, how much stronger, and how much more efficient you feel in a lot of contexts. And I find that once people can get that buy-in in the beginning, and they can get over the hump where it's like, oh, this is something I have to do, where it's like, no, this is something I get to do that's different from my immediate sport that is going to complement that sport and likely, make my life better after I retire from that sport, or stop competing at the highest level, or whatever that might look like for the person. Because if we look at the things that make life more difficult as we get older, it's fragility, lack of independence, sarcopenia, osteopenia. And I find people who have been maybe more immersed in running their whole life and who don't have a substantial amount of muscle mass. And we're not talking about looking like Mr. Olympia here, right? But having a decent amount of muscle mass and lifting a few times a week, like having a bare minimum of these things, those are things as people get in their older years that could put them at risk for falls or fractures or impaired bone health. And I find that as you're trying to optimize your performance, we have these small opportunities from a nutrition standpoint to eat enough, to get enough nutrients, get enough protein, but to also complement what our primary training is with the second form of training. That's how people can optimize their performance and live, happily ever after, however you want to say it. But just training is, long as I've been in this space, it's something that I've been fascinated of how much it can impact, endurance types of sports. And it's something that I've seen play out firsthand. And I appreciate that response because there's just so many factors at play here for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure. For sure. I feel like the question now is where it's like, okay, cool. I'm nodding my head. Of course, lifting is good. We don't have to be Olympic power lifters, but like getting in the gym maybe one, two, three times a week, whatever it is. The question then becomes like, how do I fit that in, right? Like, how is that something that I have to add on top of what I'm already doing? And I think it's that. I think people understand how important these things are, but I think it's the practicality for some. And assuming, we're talking to general people here who, want to run their half marathon or run a fast 10K. Maybe they don't do this for a living, but how do we start to structure in some of these types of forms of resistance training, or start to sprinkle that in or increase that in addition to what they're already doing? I'm curious of how you might go about that, or how you've built that in, or how you personally experience that, because we all have a finite amount of time of how much stuff we can do every week, and just tacking on more and more and more isn't practical and can be detrimental in certain contexts as well. So how do we strategically start improving this or increasing the volume without jeopardizing our health or, the time restraints that we have, and actually making that work within someone's schedule?
Yeah, so I always like to say write out your non-negotiables for, I typically say at least for the week. And then we kind of play Tetris around that. So if you truly are like, I only have an hour to train Monday through Friday, then we work with that. And it might be that I'm just gonna kind of make up a plan here. You run Monday, Wednesday, Friday. We strength train Tuesday, Thursday. I actually would do Monday, Wednesday, Thursday. You run, you strength train Tuesday, Friday, just to give some 3 days in between that. And then Saturday, Sunday might be longer days. And really, 2 to 3 days, 30 to 45 minutes of strength training for an endurance athlete is plenty. That is sufficient. That is enough to build and maintain muscle mass. Again, with the stimulus of nutrition as well. And more is not better here. So I definitely would not want to see a session over an hour because there's muscular fatigue with that, right? And we're not getting any benefit at that point. And as like I mentioned earlier, as your volume for your main sport increases, That strength training is an added stress, right? And so we don't just add more on that. We maybe your strength training comes down. Maybe it was 45 minutes, maybe we reduce that to 30 minutes because now you're adding volume in your run in this scenario. And so we want to be cognizant of that. We might move from heavy lifts to a little bit lighter, more endurance style lifts. That might come down to body weight or resistance. Like specifically looking at things like plyometrics can be really beneficial in those peak phases of racing. And so there's a ton we can do with this, is really what I want to get at. And if you truly have like that, only an hour, say during the weekdays, if you have a coach or you're doing your own plan, like be realistic with yourself. Don't set yourself up for failure. Don't get me, if you have an hour, don't set yourself up to say, oh, I'm going to do an hour and a half today. You're not going to do it, right? So just, give yourself grace. It's okay.
Agreed. Yeah, agree more. And I think it's an unfair question to ask because it does require so much nuance and individualization. That's it's hard to give general recommendations for a lot of these things. And I think at the end of the day, it's like objectively looking at. I like your non-negotiables. I think that comes from a place of like, hey, what am I working towards? What are my primary goals? Do I have timelines? Am I in season or my off season? Like having these other elements that can kind of factor into this decision-making process, like the non-negotiables are important because that's a reflection of everything else that you're working towards right now. So I think that's a lovely exercise. I think everybody should do that every single week, quite frankly, just like prioritize what it is they need to be doing. And there's just a greater likelihood that we can execute on that when we actually map out what we need to do for the week instead of just taking it day by day. But it really does come down to like, what are the other influencing variables that might dictate whether we do more of a plyometric kind of lighter two sessions 30 day or 30 minutes a week versus like, hey, it's off season, maybe we can lift a little heavier, we can actually focus on incorporating new movements and start to learn technique about other things, and it's not as consequential and not as important as what we're doing now compared to 3 weeks away from a race and we're trying to start lifting now. It's like same thing with nutrition. It's like you're not going to experiment with a whole new fueling or hydration plan the day before the day of your race that you've been racing for. And I want people to appreciate that is like, we have to take this slowly. And I think the hard part for endurance athletes, for people type A, myself, everyone else in general who have that personality trait, it's like we hear these things and we want to implement everything right away. But it takes effort to do that slower. And it takes effort to incorporate that with baby steps instead of these people being like, there's this thing that can improve this, and this is something that I can get benefit from. Like, I'm going to try and maximize that as much as possible, where, like you alluded to, too much too soon can actually be detrimental in certain contexts. So we have to take it individual basis here, but I wrote down 2 to 3 days, 30-minute sessions, maybe 45-minute sessions. You think about that out loud, and relatively speaking to everything else that these athletes might be doing, that sounds very, minuscule compared to some other stuff. So it is a low minimum effective dose here. And that's something I want people to take with them too. It doesn't have to be 4 days a week of lifting in addition to their 4 or 5 days of training each week.
And that certainly could be too much volume. And I mean, same thing as we would with run volume. Like that bone stress is a real thing. And that, that can definitely impact you.
Totally. Just thinking out loud here. Maybe we just do like a case study, and maybe we could just talk through, you can kind of help us talk through like how we would maybe structure your training or what things you might tell somebody to prioritize given the certain season that they're in. But it's beginning of the year. Let's say a client comes to you and we have a race or some event that we're going to train for in October, for example. So maybe we're 7, 8 months away from this event. Technically, it's quote unquote the off season. Maybe I'm making up shit here, so correct me or shit if it doesn't line up. But maybe that 2, 3 months before that event is when they're really focused, dialed in, and that's when they're leading up to that event. But from now, for the next 2, 3 months, it's maybe the off season. Then we have a little preseason, and then we have in season. How would you structure if someone's sitting here today and maybe they're lifting one day a week, or maybe they're not lifting at all? What would we start with in the off season, and how would we transition that leading up to maybe race time? And again, this could be very broad, general stuff here, but how would that look different from month to month, if at all, as we get closer to when this person is maybe going to start ramping up, their training volume or their miles for the week, for example?
Yeah, so I always work backwards from race day. That's like their A race. So we get more specific towards race day, and further away from race day, we get less specific. We might be working certainly different energy systems. In kind of the off season, we are doing more heavy lifts, as I mentioned, and on the endurance side, we're doing like more sharpening, as I like to call it, like VO2 work, lactate threshold work, like all of the redlining stuff that some athletes love and some athletes are like, oh man. So that more or less is what it would look like. And when I'm saying heavy lifting, what I want to emphasize here is like, we're not going to the gym and doing all of these huge movements. It's going to be typically one exercise of a bigger movement, a deadlift, a squat, and we're lifting heavy there. And keeping in mind, heavy is really anywhere from 1 to 6 reps is what the goal is. And on that sixth rep, you should be kind of questioning if you can get up from that. That is heavy lifting. If you are just getting started, please don't lift that heavy. Be realistic with what you can do. And then the rest of the movements, they might be more functional. So you might be doing, a single arm overhead, like you're lifting a kettlebell overhead and you're doing a lunge with that. So you're stabilizing through your core. You might be doing a single leg art, like Romanian deadlift or something that's a little bit more, as I like to call, functional than just that one big movement. So we're doing one big movement, maybe 3 to 4, still heavy lifting, but more of those functional movements. And that's what that would look like. Again, probably 2 days a week I'm having you do that, and then some of that VO2 thresholds anaerobic work. And we're periodizing that. So it's typically a 3 week of a 3 week Or it's a 4 week block in total, but 3 weeks really of work build, one deload week, and then we're switching gears. And so, yeah, that's more or less what it would look like.
Lovely, lovely. And I think people can kind of sit with that and appreciate that, like, okay, yeah, some of these bigger compound lifts, some of these lifts where we're working multiple muscle groups, you do a barbell RDL or even a regular deadlift, or you do a squat or some squat pattern, or you're doing leg presses. It's like, it's a lot of muscles working there at once, your quads and your glutes, maybe your hamstrings, depending on what movement that we're doing, pairing those with things that, and again, I like the word functional in these contexts because it is applicable to the sport that you're playing. Kind of like lifting workout space, functional can get like the definition can get a little wishy-washy with like people's things. That's like, does this general mom need to be doing a squat into a shoulder press into a push-up pattern? It's like, no, maybe not, but these instances are absolutely applicable. And it's like, hey, we're using our delts and our core, and we're doing a lunging pattern, which is kind of reflecting something, we're doing with our stride, and we're getting more power output with that. Like, it's like, how are we doing exercises that are complementing what kind of endurance sport we're doing? So I think that appreciating the fact that, like, yeah, we're lifting and we're training relatively close to failure. Maybe if you're lifting alone, like getting within 2, 3 reps of failure instead of like going to a failure with a barbell back squat, I agree with you. That's probably not the best idea for people, but training hard here, And I think that's the thing we want to appreciate is like, it's not something that we're going in and you do your 10, walking lunges on one side and, you do your RDLs on the other and you leave and you didn't break a sweat and you didn't get your heart rate up. Like, you're probably not training hard enough in those contexts. So being able to train closer to failure and appreciate what that feels like. So when you do get to your deload week and then you start your new training program, you're kind of periodizing these things, but we're not training to failure every single session, but we better be training hard, relatively speaking, in all these sessions. And that's, again, I think the benefit of getting a coach, because you start to appreciate all of these inputs and all these things that you're like, it's hard to account for those things if you're somebody who's just trying to write your own training program or trying to incorporate this on your own. But following people or even asking for help for a period of time can teach you more than you know. And I think that people, again, wanting to get to their best place, like we have to be willing to ask for help in some of those contexts. And most people do.
Totally. Yeah.
You mentioned deload. I want to transition into the rest part of this conversation, because I think we can
Yeah.
all nod our head in agreements of like eating's important, resistance training is important, not doing too much is important. Rest and recovery, I would argue, is also just as important. Like if we look at all of these things that we would quote unquote say are important, if rest and recovery and getting enough sleep or taking care of yourself or minimizing the amount of stress that we're burdening our body with every week, if that is not a priority, anything that we've talked about until this point isn't going to fucking matter, because over time you're going to increase your risk for injuries and, you know, just like tendonitis or your inability to be motivated to go and train or your ability to progress, or you're going to be overtraining. And there's just a lot of consequences that can come from not recovering appropriately. And I think, again, that's another area of people's lives where it's hard to appreciate how important that is and how that's kind of the dictating factor on whether or not you keep progressing at a rate in which you want to see over time. So where does this rest and recovery part of the conversation come into? Because you've alluded to that a lot, and I want to talk about how we're prioritizing that, what things you're saying or what minimum rest kind of recommendations look like for you for a particular athlete. Again, it's going to be dependent on the person and how much they're doing and how much they can tolerate and how long they've been doing this, of course, but what is the sales pitch to prioritizing rest and recovery for people who are not doing that? And how can we start to conceptualize that and implement that?
Yeah, so I always say like rest is the easiest for folks to cut into, but is the most detrimental on health and performance. And I mean, we know this, like, but a lot of the time, again, because it's the easiest thing for people to cut into, we don't pay attention to it as much. And it really truly is the only time when the body has an uninterrupted space to adapt to all of the training that you're doing. And if we don't allow for that to happen, we are just like piling stress on top of stress on top of stress. And eventually, like, there's going to be a breaking point, whether that's injury, illness, burnout. The body is not going to keep going forward. It's going to stop at some point. And so I personally learned this like earlier in my athletic career. And just like learning to step back. And I really appreciate rest days now, and deload weeks. Whereas before I was like, balls to the wall, go train as hard as you can, do it all. And now I'm like, no, like I'm actually gonna rest today. And true, like, I like take your rest seriously is what I always tell my athletes is when it's a rest day, that doesn't mean we're going on a 6 mile hike. That doesn't mean we're going out and making sure we hit 10,000 steps. Today, you're kicking your feet up and I want you to like melt into the couch, you know? I don't want you doing all the things. And it's hard to do. And I'm saying this obviously from a place of privilege because I don't have kiddos yet, because I train some moms and you're gonna be chasing around a toddler, right? And like rest doesn't necessarily happen exactly in the same scenario, but you know, still find that way. And that's, you know, moving outside of just a singular rest day or a deload week, seriously looking at your sleep. And honestly, making this non-negotiable. I talked about that earlier, but if you have to, and I actually have to do this, I turn my phone on sleep mode at a certain time every night, mainly so I'm not getting emails anymore. Because I'm somebody that if somebody emails me, I think it's urgent and I have to answer it. And, you know, we don't, but that's just my brain. And so I turn it on sleep mode. It goes, and that's about 30 minutes before bed. So I don't access apps. I don't access like email, you know, all the things. And I prioritize it. And that's really just the nature of what it is. And what research has shown is like 7 to 9 hours a night. I know some athletes, myself included, like when I'm in a peak phase of training, I'm like 9 to 10 hours a night, and that I like feel it. I need it. I feel it when I don't get that in my performance. So it's, everyone's definitely unique in that way.
Yeah, really well said. I like that we're talking about other components of stress that can, if people can imagine like their body is like this bucket and we're just adding drops of water or streams of water to this. You look at all the things that could make your stress bucket, figuratively speaking, overflow for the day. We're talking about training, we're talking about resistance training and running, right? We're talking about nutrition, like especially nutrition could be one of those things where we're removing water when done appropriately. If you're eating enough and, like not restricting calories and getting enough carbs and eating around your training, like eating sufficient amount of calories, protein, and fueling for your sport is a stress reducer for a lot of people. But for a lot of people, diet can also be another form of stress on their life, if they're not paying attention to it, right? But you add that, we add sleep, we add life stress, we add just day-to-day job stress, we have financial stress for people, we have stress of people watching the news and getting pissed the fuck off every single night. Like there's so many types of forms of stress that can make your stress bucket overflow. And when you are dealing with athletes and we're talking about people doing all the things that we're kind of alluding to right now, where you're training a lot and you're training more than 5 hours a week and you're preparing for events, it's like those types of people are already close to the border of like, not getting injured, but, maybe getting burnt out or having a setback or getting to the point of overtraining. Like those people are living closer to that line than the general person trying to get one cardio session in for the week. So we bring all this up, and I'm happy you bring all those up because I want people to appreciate how many inputs there are and how trying to put effort into controlling the controllables, and you're not going to be a stress-free person ever again. Like that's just not something that is realistic, nor is it something that people need to expect. But acknowledging what things bring you stress and choosing to do things about them are very important. And that's what's going to help you keeping high performance. It's going to help you adapt to the training that you're trying to adapt to. It's going to help you become a better athlete. It's going to help you handle more. It's going to make you not become sick or have an injury or have to deal with shit along the way. And I think that's what I want people to take home is that rest and not active rest days. I like that you alluded to, I'm going to do a rocking fucking 8 mile hike up the Colorado Rockies this weekend. It's like, that's not a rest day, but like, yeah, just doing general stuff, not lifting, not training, doing stuff around the house, like hanging out with the kids. But like taking those days are the things that can prevent you from going over that line. And that's very consequential for a lot of people. And I want people to kind of comprehend that because it's kind of hard for us to sit here as type A personality people to think that that's productive. But in reality, actually prioritizing your rest is the most productive thing that you could do in all other aspects of your life if you're doing it correctly.
Absolutely. That's like one of the my favorite pieces of advice that I've had is rest is productive. And it just really, like, anytime I'm like, on my rest day or whenever I'm like itching to do more, I'm like, no, like not today. Rest is productive. We've got to like take that back seat for a second. So.
Absolutely. And we mentioned the word deload, and I don't know if everyone's heard of that word before. I know my audience has, and my clients have. I'll speak to how I incorporate it, and I'd love to hear how you incorporate it because you kind of alluded to it already, personally and with your clients. But deload, again, if people have never heard that word, it's like we're temporarily kind of taking a step back or reducing the amount of volume or training or your intensity. For me, it's like people going into the gym. It's like maybe we're not working out at all that week, or we're doing an intro week where we're doing far less sets or less weight or not going to failure. We're like intentionally not working out as hard as we normally do, right? And some of the benefits to that are, yeah, we can reduce fatigue and we can kind of resensitize to the training stimulus that we're trying to consistently implement, whether that's the form of, in the hypertrophy world where we're resistance training and trying to make, muscle adaptations, or in the endurance world where you're trying to continue to set PRs and improve your endurance and your, mitochondrial function, like all of these things. Like they can only do so much if you're periodically along the way taking steps back so you can keep taking steps forward. So for me personally, I'll have a training program. I write to a client maybe on the fifth or sixth week, usually sixth, seventh week. We have a deload week where, hey, this program's done. We're going to take a step back. Maybe we adjust things with our nutrition. Maybe I get your new program. Maybe we talk about what we're doing. We can experiment with new movements, get form videos, like get dialed in, but we're not training as hard that week intentionally. So come week one, come week two of the next program, we can start ramping up volume and then we can keep making progressions that way. That is kind of traditionally how I use it and kind of in the resistance training sphere, how we might implement that. Is that similar or are there similar strategies from an endurance standpoint? And even pairing that with the resistance training type of thing, is that something you do together? Or on deload weeks where you're not running as much, is that a time where, hey, maybe training 3 days a week instead of two in the gym could be helpful? Like, I'm curious how you structure all of these things together because there's more inputs here that we have to account for compared to somebody just lifting 3 or 4 days a week, right? So, how does that work for you?
Yeah.
And add or subtract anything that I said from that. But I just want to talk about deloads for a sec because I don't think people in the endurance space talk about it as much as you do.
Yeah. Very similar in the endurance space. So, a kind of traditional build is that first week is going to be your highest volume. Second week kind of follows that. Third week is going to be similar in that sense. That fourth week, the deload week, we're cutting your total volume and training down by like 10 to 20%. So there's still gonna be your usually like 1 to 2 intense days in there, whatever kind of block we're in. And then a lot of zone two work. And then your strength training days, typically we do like to see that deload week follow where we are doing maybe less sets of that specific workout, or it's lighter weight, but still hitting 2 to 3 sessions that week. But we typically are bringing the total session time down in that scenario. So very similar pattern.
Awesome. I feel like it's very similar with all things. It's just how you do it, but it's the principles that stay the same. It's like, hey, we're gonna fucking do less so we can keep doing more over time. And if you don't do that, if you have somebody that just goes hard for the next 8 weeks, chances are if you don't need a deload, you're not working hard enough, quite frankly. Or if you are, your body is gonna force a deload on you in the form of injury, getting sick, lack of motivation, regression in certain contexts, and your body will tell you if and when it needs to take a step back. So it happens one way or another. And I find that pre-planning it for people in the resistance training world helps. I know it's the same in the endurance space. So I think people just accounting for that as they look, at their training plan for the week and month and appreciating that week as much as they appreciate their peak weeks. They both have the, not same utility, but they have both have a layer of importance that they can't exist without one another.
Absolutely.
I love it. Last, I want to end on a, I don't know if a light note, but I want to talk about some supplements and talk about, if maybe there are things that you like or things that piss you off or stuff that you've experienced. I want to introduce the supplement part of this conversation because I think, again, in this population, supplementation is necessary in certain contexts, but it can be also be overly done or overly emphasized or the primary approach for some people. And we gotta appreciate the fact that supplements are here to fill in the cracks. They're not the big rock here. And I know a lot of people understand that, but actions speak differently for a lot of people and clients sometimes, right? So when we have all of these, we talked about resistance training, we talked about recovery, and we're deloading and we're eating enough carbs and we're dialed in with our nutrition, and now we get to the point where we're talking about supplements, especially specific for endurance athletes. I want to shift this conversation here, but what are supplements where you would list in tier one? In my notes, I wrote like, hey, three supplements that every endurance athlete should consider taking, right? I say consider taking because not everybody should take everything. Yeah, there's generalizations we could make, but what are tier one? And then maybe we talk about, hey, what's kind of fringe? What are things that maybe the science isn't there to back up, but maybe anecdotally have tried or people live and swear by things that might be worth effort if everything else is intact. And then what are some things that are just straight up fucking dumb or a waste of time or a waste of money or not going to give you any return on your investment compared to other things that we could be doing. And please feel free to restructure this in any way possible. We can go back and forth if you want, but we can do like good supplements, bad supplements. Just tell me about some of the good ones, some of the bad ones, and some of the ones in between.
Yeah, so I put a note down and I was like, dare I say carbohydrate? Because it's not necessarily a supplement.
Dun, dun,
I mean, if we're
dun.
looking at sports nutrition, there's lots of sports nutrition supplements that have carbs in them. But the reason why I put this down is because I don't think enough athletes use this to their full potential. Chronically, I see carbohydrates underconsumed. And they are a performance aid, right? We know that in order to perform at your peak potential, you need carbs on board to hit those high intensities. You know, think about climbing a hill, taking off on a sprint to the finish, whatever the case may be, like that is carbohydrate. So I'm gonna list that just for one. Caffeine in the endurance space is huge. I'm sure it's big in the bodybuilding space. Resistance training, strength as well. I love this for athletes. I think it's great. It's a very well-studied supplement. Can be super beneficial. What else? Creatine, time and place. And I know this is big in strength and resistance, but gosh, so many benefits, right? Especially for my perimenopause menopausal ladies, vegan, vegetarian athletes, we see huge improvements there in muscle mass and also recovery, all of that.
I'm going to stop you there and we can recap a little
Yeah.
because
Okay.
it's funny. And feel if were you going to add any more on the good list or were you done with that? Sorry for interrupting.
No, I think those are the three C's. Those are good.
I'm happy you bring those three up because if we look at what has been replicated and researched and the most applicable to especially endurance athletes, it's probably those three supplements, right? Carbs.
Totally.
I want people to appreciate the fact that if you're not, a high level endurance athlete, like you don't need to be hitting 500 grams or more carbs per day if you don't want to. Like you can get away with that, some people, but man, like some of the recommendations, 7, 8, 9, 10 grams per kilogram of body weight for how much carbs you should be eating. Man, some athletes realize like, holy shit, I'm eating 600, 700 grams of carbs at least a day. And you look at your nutrition and it's like, holy shit, I'm getting 400, which better than none. But when you realize that these goos and these carbohydrate drinks and some of these, types of quick, convenient, simple sugar carbohydrate sources, they absolutely do and need to have a place if we're talking about optimal performance sometimes. So I'm happy you list carbs and just the, family tree of what that might look like, because there's a lot of different forms of that. But I'm happy you bring that up because I want us to appreciate the fact that that can be a supplement and we're supplementing more things with the diet. And that's okay if we do that, even if they're quote unquote processed. So
Yes.
I love that. I think that's great. And it's funny. I asked a question on my check-in form to my clients this week. It was like, hey, what is the most important supplement for an endurance athlete? And I had creatine, I had caffeine, I had BCAAs, and then I had whey protein. And the answer I was looking for was caffeine. Because again, if we look at what's been studied, what we've researched, caffeine as an ergogenic aid is in a tier of its own, especially when it comes to, endurance athletes. And it absolutely can be used in the lifting community and stuff, but it has the most applicability to people doing these longer and kind of endurance sports. And creatine as well. Creatine being very different from caffeine because creatine is not something that you get acute benefits, right? Like you take creatine, you supplement with it, you take it consistently, you top off your creatine stores. That's where you get its benefit, where caffeine is something that you take it 20, 30 minutes before a race. And that's when you feel its immediate benefits. And that's where you get the performance enhancing benefits from that supplement as well. So I'm happy you listed those. I was thinking the exact same things, but they're not very sexy, like people want to sit here and talk
No.
about beta alanine and, EAAs and BCAAs and baking soda, all these things. It's like, no, like let's stick to these three, four that are really the most important. Then if we need to add from there, we can, but you're going to get the most bang for your buck with those.
Yeah, totally. Like, keep it simple. It's, we know there's research to support those guys, so
Absolutely.
yeah.
Oh yeah. Any
Yep.
others on that list or any ones now that you're like, hey, could be worth a thought potentially?
Yeah. I think magnesium, I think, can be valuable. You know, I have, and this is really common in the endurance space, is like really long sessions, really long races, lots of difficulty sleeping after, and that just like come down. So I think magnesium and actually tart cherry juice kind of can, there's good research to support those guys. Those might, I think, you know, be kind of in the shade of gray, I guess, if you will. Some people respond differently to those things, but can certainly be beneficial. I mean,
In timing of those, is that important
timing, yeah.
related to race day or like, sorry, training days, off days? Is there a general rule of thumb where it's like, hey, if you do these things, maybe take it at this time or around this each week? Or is it not as specific with some of those?
Yeah, I mean, with both magnesium and tart cherry juice, if we're using it for the benefit of like sleep and coming down at the end of the day, I typically say like 30 minutes to an hour before bed, and just like, you know, there's magnesium powders that, like, personally I like to mix in like hot water, and I sip on that before bed, or the tart cherry juice, like mix it in some sparkling water, or have it as like a little shot and be done for the day.
That's great. I usually recommend right before bed as well, or around bedtime, and that's where you get the most benefit from it. And you know, maybe getting some melatonin too from tart cherry or whatever we get a nutrient standpoint from those are great. But it's nice to have like a ritual and a routine. And if you take other vitamins, like I find that those are easy things that people can do at the end of the night sometimes that are, they don't take much effort. Or maybe you take your magnesium and your creatine and whatever else, and before you know it, you're building a routine around that. It's like, how can we be adherent and consistent with this instead of I take tart cherry juice once every other week and you know it's not working for me? It's like, yeah, no shit. Like, we need to actually give it a shot and see if
Yeah.
this is worth incorporating. Love it.
Yeah, 100%.
Any on the other end of the spectrum where you're like, somebody come here and I'm taking X, Y, and Z, and you're just like, okay, stop, or don't need this, or this could be hurting you. Like, are there supplements that come to mind or things that you've seen and become popular that you wish weren't?
Honestly, like in the endurance space, I see iron as a supplement way, way, way overconsumed. And sometimes I have men coming to me, which, right, you don't have a period. And so you're not losing an extreme amount, like not an extreme, but you're not losing blood every month, right? So, like, the over supplementation is a real thing. And iron is, it builds up in your body and can become toxic. So I'm always like, pause, please stop. And let's order some labs to see if this is even necessary, because that it can end up doing more harm. So that's a big one for me. What else?
I imagine I'm happy you bring that up. That didn't even cross my radar, but I feel like even seeing people supplement with iron, like even the effects it can have on your digestive tract can be kind of harsh sometimes, which if we
Yeah.
have somebody we're really trying to optimize and make sure that you can handle that many carbs and handle that amount of hydration and handle that amount of food and you know, utilize all of those things and you have a supplement that's potentially disrupting that or making you feel like shit, agreed. I've, that's a very fascinating one. And again, it's just the obsession with like the hyper optimization of every little thing, whether or not people think it's helping, you know, like you have no idea what your labs are, but you're taking some of these specific, you know, type of supplements
Yeah.
that might be putting you at risk for toxicity. Again, that's where we have problems. And that's where social media and some of these trends, or your running group and someone's taking iron and they're female and they have use for it. You're a guy and you're somebody there's like, oh, I should take that too because it delivers oxygen, right? And I'll be better. It's like, yeah, it's not how that works, dude.
Yeah. I mean, even females, I see females over supplement with it too, and it's just test before you supplement. Especially with some of those, like, you know, very specific supplements out there. Yeah, super important.
Love it.
I'm
There, sir.
going to say ketones. and I'm gonna get a lot of hate for this.
Did it. Yep.
Ketones in performance. So we don't have good research to support ketones for endurance performance. There's potentially some benefits in recovery. So that's kind of where, maybe if you're using it, if you are in a phase where you are specifically overreaching, so you're training a lot, and you're purposely like, the best way I like to describe this is think of like training camps, where you are, that's what the purpose is of that camp. You might see benefits in using ketones in that recovery, so you can, recover at the end of the day, get back out there, do the same thing tomorrow. In endurance performance, the research just is not there yet. And there's some research even indicating that it can actually hurt performance. So probably going to get a lot of hate for that one, but I'm just stating the facts.
Sure. I'm happy you bring that up because I think when we talk about these things, like of course there's different means of taking them or reasons people might take them, but I find with exogenous sources of ketones that it's the idea of them that sounds more exciting than the actual benefit that you might actually get from them too, especially as we're looking at endurance athletes and especially like a well-fed endurance athlete, and you're having somebody or somebody's intentionally taking exogenous ketones. And, I've seen in similar situations where it's almost impairing carbohydrate metabolism, where it's impacting their ability to actually, their body to do its job because it has this other fuel source now where it's like more isn't better. It's like you have all these sources of fuel. It's like, no, your body can only do so many things at once or, work these systems, so quickly. And I find that just taking shit just to take it in these situations, it might have more negative effects or, at worst, no effect at all than actual benefits than what people might think they'd be getting from that. And I think that's, again, why not blindly taking things and not spending $50 on a little vial of, ketones or whatever. Like those are things that, yeah, maybe if you experiment in the off season, you notice a difference, go crazy. But for most people, it's just not where people's heads should be at with this stuff.
I think again, just taking it back to the basics and not trying to reach for like that shiny object for that next gain when we don't have the research to support it. Especially like at that price tag, like one of those shots, some of them are like $100. I'm like, man, that's an expensive experiment.
Thank you for that. Any others that case closed on things that you'd have as a potential red flag?
I think my last one is sodium bicarbonate. I get really nervous when athletes are telling me they're taking this, especially endurance athletes. This, the research again on this is done on sprint distance athletes, think anywhere from 1 to 10 minutes. So I guess that's sprint and middle distance, 1 to 10 minutes. That really, like, we're producing a ton of lactate. Sodium bicarb is like the goal is right to interrupt that lactate production, which arguably is actually beneficial. We need lactate production. But when we look at endurance sport, there's like, we're out there for such a long time. We get concerns of GI stuff, stomach cramping, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, all the things that already are a really high incidence in endurance sport. So adding, this is kind of adding fuel to the fire, if you will, which I don't think, again, the research there is there to support the use of that. So,
Yeah, nice, nice. Thank you for that. Baking, people don't know who sodium bicarb is, just baking soda, it just for people to think about, it's like, oh damn, that stuff that's in my fridge, you can take that as a ergogenic aid. It's like, yeah, it has some use, I like that. Maybe differing populations or types of sports again might get better benefits versus others. So I love that. I don't think those are controversial at all, but I know that in the space in athletes, and again, we're looking for every ways to optimize anything possible. And what sucks sometimes, and I know you've probably shared this experience, is like when you think something is going to help you and then somebody else says it might not or it probably won't, it's like, oh, that's gut-wrenching. But I want that to be a good thing. I want people to appreciate the fact that, oh, it's one less thing I have to worry about, or maybe it's not something that should be in tier one, two, three, four, or five of what hierarchy of importance I'm trying to focus on right now. And I think
Yeah.
the purpose of me asking this question is like, how can we be a little bit more minimalist and appreciate the things that we have robust ground, important research on that is likely going to give us a return on our investment instead of wasting our time experimenting with things that might not give us that same benefit. So thank you for recapping that. I think that was perfect.
Awesome. Yeah.
You've been super generous with your time. I appreciate all this chat. It was really fun. I feel like I was able to cover a lot of the topics I haven't been able to cover with other endurance athletes. So this really rounded out a lot of stuff that I think has been missing. Super helpful and fun. Tell the people where they can find you, how they can get a hold of you. Anything else you want to plug? Floor is yours, but I'll put everything in the show notes as well so people can find you there.
Yeah, so on Instagram, I'm just a dash of Dana. That's probably the best place to find me. My website's also a dash of Dana.us. And then I do have like endurance coaching side of things through Zeal Endurance Coaching. So the a dash of Dana side is my performance nutrition. Zeal Endurance Coaching is the endurance side. So that's me.
Thank you, Dana. I appreciate you. This was fun.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you again for listening to this episode. If you found value and enjoyed it, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media. If you do, make sure you tag me so I can say thanks. Or if you're on iTunes, scrolling down and leaving a 5-star review would be much appreciated. And if you ever want to get in touch with me, you can always find me on Instagram at LukeSmithRD. Thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you have an amazing rest of your day. I'll see you on the next episode.